Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of ActorCast. So excited to have all of you here listening to the latest and greatest information happening in the entertainment industry, from theater to film and television. If you haven't already done so, be sure to head to actorcast.fm and sign up for our newsletter, where you could receive information on upcoming guests, showcases, and much more. So head to actorcast.fm and sign up there. Everyone, we have an amazing guest joining us on the show today. His name is Stuart F. Lane, and Stuart is the CEO, president, and co-founder of Broadway HD, the CEO of Theater Venture Inc., and he is also a six-time Tony Award-winning producer. He has worked on a wide variety of different productions, such as Jay Johnson, The Two and Only, Thoroughly Modern Millie, The Will Rogers Follies, Warhorse, and many others. He has also created scholarship funds at Columbia University Business Graduate School and Boston University College of Fine Arts Undergraduate School. And he has just given so much to a variety of both educational and artistic institutions. I always enjoy talking with Stuart a lot because, as you'll see in this episode, he is very passionate about the theater industry. He's very passionate about Broadway, and he loves what he does as a producer. In this episode, we talk about Stuart's journey and how he became a Broadway producer, what he enjoys most about the producing world, and also what are some of the biggest challenges involved in being a producer. We discuss his work as a writer and how that has informed his work as a producer. And we also discuss why it's important for actors, performers, as well as other artists to have a foundational understanding of what it means to be a producer today. We also talk briefly about his work with Broadway HD and how him and fellow theater producer Bonnie Comley are working together to digitize the theater landscape. It's very exciting work that they're doing. So if you like this episode, please be sure to head to actorcast.fm and leave us a review. Leaving us a review does a lot in spreading awareness about the show and letting people know about the various wonderful things that you are learning from our guests on ActorCast. So, without further ado, let me please introduce today's guest of ActorCast, Stuart F. Lane. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the ActorCast. Today, we have an amazing guest joining us. His name is Stuart F. Lane. He is the Chief Executive Officer, the President and Co-Founder of Broadway HD, Chief Executive Officer of Theater Venture Inc., and he's also a six-time Tony Award-winning producer for a wide variety of different productions. Stuart, I'm very excited to have you here on the show today.
No, I'm excited to be here, Patrick. Really something.
Yes. We had the opportunity to connect on my other podcast. I guess it was a little less than a year ago. I had the opportunity to talk with both you and Bonnie. And I was very inspired by both of your stories, getting into this world, getting into the industry. And so when I created this show, I guess about maybe 6 to 9 months ago, I really wanted to reach out to both of you again and have you on the show. So I'm so excited that you could be here today and we could dive into this conversation.
Oh, well, I'm always excited to talk about theater, and especially with you.
Oh, thank you. So I'm wondering, for those of our listeners who may not be familiar with you, I'm just wondering if you could start off by sharing a little bit about your journey. I know that you started off as an actor, but how did you come to become a Broadway producer?
Well, that's an interesting story, and I'll try and keep it as short and as interesting as possible. You know, I graduated with a BFA in acting and theater from Boston University. Terrific program. And although I didn't make it into the Holy Grail back then was regional theater. You know, train out there, then come to New York. But I came right to New York, and I was lucky enough and really worked hard to get into SAG, AFTRA, Equity, the three major unions. I did summer stock. I did dinner theater. I did some little TV extra work and movies. But it was a tough time in the 70s in New York for the theater and the economics in general. And everyone was leaving town. I mean, the Johnny Carson, the late night host, left New York. The Broadway was having a tough time. You were lucky. You didn't even have enough shows to complete the categories in musical theater during that time. I mean, there was a dearth of entertainment. So California was the place to go. I love New York. It's a walking city. I love the town, love the theater. But everyone was going to California. So off I went to California. And they hate theater in California. They really do. They go, oh, you couldn't find real work? You work in the theater, you know. So it was that kind of attitude, that because there's no money in it. You do it for the love of it and for your craft. I think that's my opinion there. But the so I spent a year in California, and it's kind of said, you know, I'm sweating for every job I had. I'm taking more classes than I'm working in terms of acting classes. So I came back to New York, and I was able to land a job with my. With a fellow I was acquainted with, the Niederlander organization, as an assistant house manager at the Brooks Atkinson Theater during the last part of Same Time Next Year, which was finishing a nice, healthy run at the Brooks Atkinson. And then I stayed on to work with Jack Lemmon in the play Tribute that was there. And then I moved over to the Alvin Theater, where Annie was playing. The Alvin is now the Neil Simon for you youngsters out there. And so after working, working or so at the theater, I said, you know, house managing has its own priorities, but challenges. But I want to be something different. I need something more challenging. And producing, and mind you, nobody wanted to be a producer in the early 1980s, late 70s. There was no money in the industry, and you know, it's like, but producing, there's a lesson there, you know. And that's like when nobody wants something, that's when you go for it. That's when you buy the shares of stock, and nobody wants it. And it gave me an opportunity to start really producing. And the first show I did, after going through a pile of scripts that Niederlander had, was a show called Whose Life Is It Anyway? It was a teleplay from the BBC that had been adapted for the stage, later made into a movie. It starred Tom Conti, and it's about this artist who's a quadriplegic, and he wants to have the right to pull the plug on himself because he can't live the life he wanted as an artist. So pithy, exciting, interesting, dramatic. And we actually won Best Actor as a Tony Award that year for Tom Conti.
Lost.
Yeah, no, we won that, but we lost Best Play to The Elephant Man. Go figure.
Oh, gotcha.
But that was my first time as an assistant to the producer, and I was starting to learn how to put a show together, how to work with the theater, how to get the press together, the marketing, and start arranging it. And so it slowly evolved that we did, and these were tough times. I mean, I went through the infamous Frankenstein. Frankenstein, for those of you who don't know, had the dubious honor of being the most expensive non-musical to close in one night.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, yes. We had a great cast. Diane Wiest, John Glover, the Carradine, the father, John Carradine, Keith Carradine's father. Because I got to work with Keith years later with Will Rogers' Follies, but this was the father. And we had recreated the entire Dr. Frankenstein lab on stage with the Jacob's ladders, you know, the zzz stuff. And at the end, the entire castle and theater collapsed on itself with boulders and surround sound shaking the seats. It was the most exciting show, and the critics hated it. I mean, they didn't just dislike it. They seemed to hate it. We ended up closing. But the silver lining there is I did make it to the wall at Joe Allen's, the wall of flops, that's up there. And there are big names up there, David Merrick is up there, and Hal Prince is up there, and yes, my name was up there with Frankenstein. So producing was a learning process. Finally, I was able to get Woman of the Year up with Lauren Bacall, and this was really good because we won several Tony Awards. We lost out on the best musical that year, but we won four, including music, and won for Cooper, best supporting actress. But the following year, in 1983 and 84 season, I was able to open La Cage aux Folles. And this was an exciting musical for me because it covered everything that I wanted to do in a production. It had social merit. It was funny. Great score by Jerry Herman. A book that was by Harvey Fierstein. And I was, you know, just trying to promote it like crazy. And my friends are going, Stu, a gay musical? That's a, you just killed your career. No one's going to go see that on Broadway. I'm going, no, you're not getting the point. It's yes, it's a gay musical, but it celebrates life. It's, you know, all the positive things. Anyway, it was a tough opening because Frank Rich of the New York Times had called it a good old-fashioned musical. And there were several of my investors that said, that's a killer. That'll kill it right there. No one wants to see an old-fashioned musical. But the people in the business are going, for a gay musical to get good old-fashioned musical, that's a stamp of approval. So it turned out to be a big hit. You know, so it was a big hit. We ran almost 5 years, and it was great. So that was how I launched my producing career. Since then, I've been able to do, you know, shows like Thoroughly Modern Millie, Legally Blonde, you know, a lot of other shows over this 40-year period. You know, this doesn't happen overnight.
Right. It. I always love hearing your story, Stuart, because it's just amazing with producing, just all the various intricacies that go into it and all the things that have to happen in order to get a show on its feet. It's really amazing just kind of hearing about how it all comes together. And I could tell by the way that you talk about it that it's something that you really enjoy doing.
Oh, I've been very fortunate that way to actually make the career work, you know, make a living at it and succeed, you know, on many levels, not only on the production, but being actually the owner of a theater, owning the Palace Theater and operating that in New York during these times. I mean, if you go through, I mean, the 70s were dark. It was a dark time for theater in New York, and theater, I was able to get a partnership into the Palace Theater with the Niederlander organization because nobody else wanted to pick it up. But a piece, again, I love the theater. I love New York. To have a piece of it. You know, I own property. And of course, Times Square back then were the three-card Monty guys, the drug dealers, the prostitutes. You know, this was not what the Disney. That's not the Times Square we have today. But I had faith in the town. You know, New York always bounces back, as you'll see when we get out of this pandemic.
Right. Yeah. I really do believe that there's going to be some sort of renaissance as things slowly but surely start to open back up. You know, hopefully this fall as things are starting to come together. I'm curious. I would love to hear your thoughts, just given your extensive career in producing theater. With the understanding that there are a lot of challenges involved in the role of a producer, but what would you say are some of the biggest challenges that you face on a regular basis with many of the shows that you work on?
There are so many challenges. I don't know where to even begin with that. Let me think, because it's a good question. Certainly when I look at a piece of material, I want to know whether it's a good show. Is it a show that, one, has compelling characters, storyline that will hold your interest. Then I'll look at the budget to see is this something that's actually doable. Does it financially make sense on an operating basis, on a week-to-week basis? And of course, today it's important to be inclusive and diversified in how we can work that into the production, both on stage and off stage, with the artistic people and the technical people. So a lot of these questions come into play. I'll also add the complete change in marketing attitude. You know, back in the day, you know, and I'm not going to go back too far, but in the 40 years ago, let's say, it was strictly the New York Times. You took an ad out in the New York Times, and that was it. That was your literary paper. That was the cultural center of New York. Although the News and the Post were good adjuncts, it was basically the New York Times that set the standard. And Frank Rich held a lot of power back in those days. So I think that they're going through expanding on that. It really got, just a lot better after that.
Yeah. It's probably in some ways kind of overwhelming how much marketing opportunities there are out there with a show. How do you determine where to kind of put that energy when promoting a show?
Well, you know, it's a big shift. We sort of went from the paper and the print to the digital. And it was a major shift in this. I don't even think the ad agencies were prepared for it when it happened, which kind of led itself really to Broadway HD and the whole concept of capturing live shows in a digital fashion. Because where's our audience going to watch this show? They're going to watch it on their laptops and their CD, or their iPads and their computers. So it's a digital form of advertising for a digital product. That I thought was pretty open, but there weren't a lot of people there who knew how to do that. Because it was really a new concept in marketing. And of course, the Broadway audiences tend to be, for the last 30, 40 years, basically, you know, they're 45-year-olds, better educated women, and better higher economic bracket. So those are your audiences, and they weren't as swift to move into the digital age as you might think. Now, certainly the pandemic accelerated a lot of that, where all of a sudden even people like me, were able to become adept at getting on and Zooming and doing all sorts of fancy things that I couldn't do beforehand on the computer. So the whole marketing really changed, and it went into digital, and even as the papers adapted themselves, I get the New York Times online now, and they still advertise in the New York Times. So that hasn't changed.
Yeah, it really is amazing just how the industry has evolved in some ways, and then in some ways it's kind of stayed the same, as you were just mentioning. I would love for you to talk about your work with Broadway HD, because this was something that both you and Bonnie had started, you know, good amount of years before the pandemic even happened. But now that the pandemic happens, the theaters can't be open, they can't run their productions. And, you know, at least from my perspective, you see an organization like Broadway HD getting a lot of coverage as an alternative, especially in these times. So I would love for you to chat with our audience just about what was the impetus behind creating Broadway HD, and then how has it served the artistic community during this unprecedented time?
Well, the concept of trying to capture a live presentation has been around since radio days. You know, even with broadcast TV, certain shows like The Fantastics or Lee J. Cobb doing Death of a Salesman were broadcast on television. In fact, we have the Lee J. Cobb version of Death of a Salesman on Broadway HD, as a matter of fact. But you could see, as time evolved and technology evolved, there was always a search to find a place for the live production, whether it was the advent of cable and pay-per-view, whether it was the advent of television, alternative content in movie theaters, whether it was the DVD market, and was there enough platforms available, and was there a critical mass of audience to really support a business like that? And it really wasn't until buffering became around and started to be developed, and you could actually watch and download a movie within seconds instead of having to wait, that we saw our audience, which was getting younger all the time and getting more enthused about what was going on in the theater, helped. This is all part of a transition that can go hand in hand. I should write a book someday. But not only did, let's say, Disney change the format of Broadway. You know, we might have had one family show a decade back in the day. You know, Oliver in the 60s, Annie in the 70s. But with the advent of family entertainment and groups of people coming, opened up a whole wide range of family entertainment on Broadway. So now you get four or five family shows a year on Broadway. And then people started refining that, getting a little more granular, by going into like the tweens that loved Wicked, or the Avenue Q crowd, because the audiences were changing. They were getting, you know, the younger ones were growing up and having families of their own, and they wanted to bring them to the theater. So it was a change of technology. It was a matter of audiences changing. And Bonnie and I, and this is a learning curve for us. This didn't happen overnight. We did a couple of shows. We did Cyrano de Bergerac with Kevin Kline that we shot, Romeo and Juliet with Orlando Bloom, and Ricola Rashad. And, and this was a sort of a learning curve. As we actually did the company with Patrick Harris.
Nice.
So it's been a learning curve that we decided that it was time to launch. It'll be 6 years in October that we've been able to do this. And I think that during that period of time, we've been able to expand our library. We have over 350 shows now, Shakespeare, musicals, West End productions, even some regional productions here in the States. So it's been an exciting tour, and we have an exciting fall period coming up, too. We have a whole list of things.
Yeah, it's amazing. What I love about it is that it is really this database. And I feel like more than just an archive, it's this opportunity to be able to see performances from a wide variety of different times. And, you know, to not only see shows that impact people and audiences today, but also impacted audiences from several years ago as well.
We have Kathy Rigby doing Peter Pan. But we have Kelly O'Hara doing King and I. And coming up this fall, as we take a step into like producing new shows that you haven't seen before on any kind of capture, I Love You, You're Perfect Now Change, celebrating its 25th anniversary since it was off-Broadway. And Joe DiPietro did the book. And Jimmy Roberts, actually an old high school friend of mine, did the music. And so it's great to be working with him again. Then we've got shows like Closer Than Ever, Richard Maltby, David Shire, a musical that we've done. It's going to be an original piece. So we're doing with that. And we had a capture from Australia called Who's Your Baghdaddy? Terrific little musical about how the war in Iraq started through the miscommunication of people and government. It's kind of fascinating, which I recommend. So there's a whole new art form here and a whole new adventure that we're going into as we hit the fall. So it's really good.
Yeah, it's really exciting to see just how things will continue to evolve as the theater space evolves and grows in these changing times. We had talked a little bit earlier in our conversation about what it is about a show that gets you to want to work on it, to produce it, to really be the fuel to the engine, so to speak. And I'm wondering if you could comment on that a little bit more, maybe perhaps elaborate, because I can only imagine as a producer, when you decide to produce a show, there is so many, as we mentioned, challenges involved, a lot of risk involved in that process as well. So what is it specifically about a show that inspires you to want to jump on board as a producer?
Yeah, you know, in terms of being inspired for it, you know, I can say I look for, you know, compelling scripts. I want to like the music. I want to see who's associated with the show. But sometimes you've got to have faith. I mean, in the case of La Cage aux Folles, I had total faith in the team we had together with Arthur Lawrence and Harvey Fierstein. I loved the music Jerry Herman had written. It all came together. I thought it was a socially important show. I thought it had a lot to say and could reach a lot of people with its message. And that I thought was really important. Then I do a show like The Will Rogers Follies, a musical biography of Will Rogers. Now, this is like an interesting book, but not compelling. But we had Tommy Tune. And Tommy Tune had a concept as a director and choreographer that's something you rely on. I had enough faith in Tommy because he's such a creative guy, a terrific fellow, that he was able to come up with ideas that you wouldn't dream of. They were really exciting, and that really made the show and put it over. And he kept working on it day after day. You know, it was a tough show because, in particular, we couldn't go out of town with it. It was such a big show, and we were running out of time. We actually did previews in New York, cold, about 3 weeks of previews before we started, three or four weeks. And so he's under the pressure of the eye of New York and the gossip columnists and what's going on. And he was a tiger. He stayed nose to the grindstone. He worked like hell on it. And it worked. In the end, we won the Tony Awards and we were a big hit. But so sometimes it's hard to tell what shows you want. I've worked with Al Pacino on several shows. And the man...
Oh, wow.
I've known him since my college days in terms of support for the theater. He did a Richard II up in Boston when I was there. That was terrific. But he's always come back to the stage. So whether he's doing the Merchant of Venice or he's even doing a show like China Doll, he's dedicated to the stage as an actor. And even if the play doesn't live up to what he can do, or if it's Shakespeare, he can handle it. I find him a terrific person to work with. So there's times there are people like that to work with. Or the chance I had to work with Peter Stone again in a revival of 1776. Terrific book writer. You know, he wrote the original 1776 and wrote several movies. He wrote the original Taking a Pelham 1, 2, 3, you know. So to get to work, and a joy to work with these people. I got to work with Betty Comden and Adolph Green. You know, giants in the industry. That just was just exciting. So when I look for a piece, I try to put all that together. And then, of course, you know, is there an audience for this show? Will they turn out for this? And, you know, generally it's worked for me. I've been able to make a living here. So that's what I would recommend. But you've got to really like the show yourself. You've got to really feel there's going to be an audience to get butts in the seats, as we say.
Right, right. I love what you're saying. Not only about kind of that visceral feeling of if you know an audience is going to like it, but also regarding the people involved in the project as well. I feel like that's something that has drawn me to the theater so much, is that it's an opportunity to collaborate with a wide variety of different types of artists, whether it's a producer, an actor, a writer, or director. And I know that in addition to being a producer, you have also directed, you've also written plays and books. And so I'm wondering if you could share how that experience has informed your work as a producer, and then also how your work as a producer has informed your work directing and writing.
Well, I've often felt that the theater, a lot of people I've worked with in the theater didn't have a sense of history, which I think is so important when you're being part of this noble profession. Of course, we became more noble later on. Early on, you know the expression, making your nut every week?
Yes.
Well, that came from traveling shows that used to go out through early America. And when a traveling theater show would come into town, the sheriff would remove the nuts from the wagon wheel so that they couldn't leave town until they paid all their debts. And if they paid all their debts, they'd make their nut back. So
I didn't know that's where it came from. That's great.
That's where it came from. So but we are a noble profession. I thought people should be more informed about the history of theater, because we didn't just create this out of a hole. We've evolved over the years. So whether I was writing on how to produce a show, which was really my personal experiences in putting on showcases and early producing, it's great for any kind of community theater, fundraising, any kind of professional off-Broadway shows you want to do. That's a great book to get, if I do say so myself. They're all great books, right, Patrick?
Of course.
And then my Jews on Broadway, well, I wanted to celebrate the Jewish contribution to the American theater, because there's so many. When you start going through the 20th century of the Marx Brothers and Kaufman and Hart and Rodgers and Hammerstein, I mean, they were the backbone of American theater, and there's nothing been written about that combined it. So I put together Jews on Broadway, and in the same vein, the Black Broadway, the contribution of the African American community to Broadway was an unsung heroes. And this was something that didn't just start in the 20th century. This started back in colonial days, where they had their own Shakespeare company. And it kind of evolved as civil rights moved on through the country. And you can see that reflected on Broadway and in the shows that were being done. So, and I actually learned a lot more about the history that I had thought to begin with, and was very proud to put together this terrific book. I had a great publisher, too, by the way. That helps. Photographs. We had the idea together to put a timeline on the bottom of the photo, so that not only did you get to see the performer, a picture of them, and learn what they did and how they did it, but also what was going on in the country at the same time in terms of civil rights and progress.
Amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. You can get that all on Amazon, by the way, if you want to get a copy.
Yeah, I'll definitely have to check that out. And would you say that experience has given you a deeper, or I guess rather a different perspective in your producing work?
Well, yes, it certainly gave me a nice foundation to work on trying to be more inclusive and diverse in the shows that are being built. And I think going back into the reopening of Broadway, you're going to see a big change in what's going on, and all for the better. Because the more diverse you get, the more ideas you get, the more creativity you get. And I think that opens up new venues that we hadn't seen before. And I think that's going to be a major plus for the Broadway audiences.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I 100% agree with you there. And, you know, we have a lot of performers who tune into the ActorCast, a lot of actors, so to speak. And I think what's really admirable about producers is that they handle so many different things. They're kind of juggling both kind of the business aspects as well as the artistic aspects, and, you know, juggling both of those things simultaneously. I'm wondering if you could share with our actors tuning in, as well as other creative professionals, as a producer, what do you believe are important things that actors, directors, and writers should know about producing?
Well, producers are the ones who take the responsibility for the entire production. Whether it works or doesn't work, it focuses on them. That's where the buck stops, as they used to say. The producer is the chairman of the board. He's the one who makes the decisions. He puts together the team. He's the one responsible. And if things go right, you can share the credit. But if things go wrong, he's the one you point a finger at. The producing, you know, when I made the transition from acting into producing, it was partially because I wanted to have at least the illusion of some control over my life. As an actor, you're constantly going with your hat in your hand and auditioning and relying on someone else to judge whether you're right or wrong for the part. And I started auditioning for people that I knew more about the theater than they did. And I'm going, why am I doing that for them? I should be sitting there. And that's sort of like, and if I succeed, I'll take the credit. And if I fail, I know I tried my best. And I have no one to blame but myself. So I didn't want to be 45 years old going, I blame this guy or that guy, or he didn't recognize me. I wanted to at least have, like I said, the illusion of some control of what was happening. And knock wood, you know, it worked out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I love what you're saying, because I think that it's important for other artists to understand, at least in a foundational standpoint, the role of a producer and how important that role is too with bringing a show into fruition. So, Stuart, I cannot thank you enough for taking the time to join me on the ActorCast today, for not only taking the time, but I also really appreciate the work and the energy that you bring to the theater industry as a producer. I could tell that you really enjoy it, which is why I always enjoy talking with you. But before we part ways, I'm just wondering if you could share with our listeners not only where they can find out more information about you and your work, but also any parting words of advice for those tuning in who are eager to get involved in the entertainment industry and specifically in Broadway.
Well, certainly I'll say, please visit us at BroadwayHD.com and visit, see our 350 shows that we have on our website. I think you'll enjoy that. The books I have, if you're producing a show, I can't recommend it enough. Let's put on a show. And for the history of the theater, both Jews on Broadway and Black Broadway can give you a real sense of how we've gotten to where we are today and how far much further we have to go. The only advice I pass on is, one, everyone has a talent in this industry. And, you know, I started off as an actor and I was able to get work, but I found that I was better at being a producer than an actor. And I know lots of people in this country, this business that's littered with people who are ex-actors who are now casting directors, producers, writers, they find other ways to express their talent other than just performing. And I think that's a very big opportunity for all of you out there to look at yourself and say, where else do I excel? There are other possibilities that you have, other talents that you have. That, and be tenacious. Don't give up. Have faith in yourself no matter what you do. If you go invest in anything or anyone, invest in yourself.
Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode of ActorCast. You can head to actorcast.fm and leave us a review to let us know what you thought of this episode. If you haven't already done so, sign up for our newsletter to get the latest and greatest information on upcoming guests, showcases, and much more. I look forward to catching you all in the next episode, and you know what time it is. It's time to go out and create.